The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
It's the Lawfare Podcast. I'm Benjamin Wittes, here with Roger Parloff, Anna Bauer, and Quinta Jurassic. Yesterday, we did a live taping of Lawfare Live talking about what's going on in South Florida, all the state cases against fake electors, about the latest goings on in New York, and of course, taking questions from our material supporters. Welcome to this week's Trump Trials and Tribulations, which may as well be called Lawfare's Trials and Tribulations, because this week has been an ordeal. Let me start by apologizing to everybody for the technical disaster of yesterday. And let me also say that these things are highly improvisational. And as you all know, we are doing this by the seat of our pants, and the seat of our pants sometimes gives you a wedgie. And so that's what happened yesterday. So today we have reverted to a different technical setup. I am here with Anna Bauer in the Lawfare Content House, but in different rooms of the Lawfare Content House, because that whole doing a studio in one room thing, that still needs a little bit of work. Roger Parloff is joining us from the Sconce studio. Quinta Jurassic is joining us from the Brookings Institution with the Endless Scream pillow in the background. And we're going to get right into it. So we're going to start with the thing you're least expecting us to start with. And we're doing this for two reasons. One is comprehensiveness, because on Lawfare Trials and Trump Trials and Tribulations, we actually want to cover the full range of this litigation, not just what's hot today. For those of you who really want to talk New York, we're going to do that a little bit later in the show. But we have some new state level criminal prosecutions going on. And I asked the estimable Quinta Jurassic to gobble them up so that she can feed them to us like baby birds. So Quinta, give us the lowdown on Arizona.
Yikes. So I will say we have a piece in Lawfare, which we can put in the chat, that we published on April 23rd that gives an overview of the range of prosecutions at the state level of the fake elector plot. So there are seven states in which there were fake electors: Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Nevada, New Mexico, Georgia, and Arizona. And we basically took a look through at what the legal proceedings have looked like in all those states. Of course, Georgia is the most famous, I think it's fair to say, indictment. The Georgia indictment did involve some of the fake electors plot, but there has been criminal process in other states as well. So in Michigan, folks may be aware, there was an indictment that was handed down, I am not quite sure when, but in the last year or so, that indicted a number of folks involved in the fake elector scheme. Recently, we actually learned over the last week from testimony that's been taking place in some of the preliminary hearings in that case that the Michigan Attorney General's Office considers Trump to be an unindicted co-conspirator in that case. And we also now have an indictment in Arizona, which appeared the other weeks. And this was an exciting one because so far, the Georgia indictment was the only one that had focused sort of beyond the boundaries of the state itself to look at, conduct in the White House in Trump's immediate vicinity. The Michigan indictment, until we learn this news about Trump as an unindicted co-conspirator, really has confined itself more to the actions of the fake electors in the state itself. And there was also a Nevada indictment that came through recently that, again, was focused very narrowly on the fake electors in that state. But Arizona is a lot more sprawling. I don't think it's quite as sprawling as the Georgia indictment, but it is a bit more expansive. So it indicts the Arizona fake electors, including former Arizona GOP chairman Kelly Ward, who may sound familiar, a number of other folks who are sort of prominent in the Arizona Republican Party, but also indicted a number of Trump associates. So initially, their names were redacted because they had not yet been served. Journalists have been able to figure out pretty easily who they are, though. And so, according to reports, the additional indictees are Christina Bobb, who is amusingly currently the RNC senior counsel for election integrity. Listeners may also be familiar with her. I believe she showed up early on in the Mar-a-Lago case. Roger, correct me if I'm wrong. Yeah, so sort of an expanded Trump universe cast of characters here. We also have John Eastman, Boris Epstein, both of whom were identified, or we believe Boris Epstein, certainly John Eastman, were listed in the federal January 6 indictment as unindicted co-conspirators, although they were not identified. We also had Jenna Ellis and Mike Roman. The last two were indicted in Georgia as well. And then, of course, last but not least, Rudy Giuliani and Mark Meadows. And then there's also a number of unindicted co-conspirators listed, chief among whom is Donald Trump. And also, interestingly, Kenneth Chesbrough, everyone's favorite cooperating witness. Since he pleaded guilty in the Georgia case, he's been going on kind of a grand tour of all of these state investigations. And one of the things that we found in our write-up is that, again and again, if you read news reports, you see that Chesbrough shows up as a cooperating witness, someone who was, extremely forthcoming before the grand jury gave prosecutors a lot of information. And so I do wonder if one of the reasons that he shows up here as an unindicted co-conspirator is essentially because he was cooperating with prosecutors and really helping them out here.
All right. So, question, which is, what is the unique work, if any, that the Arizona case is doing over and above, say, the Michigan case and the Georgia case? I mean, the Georgia case has some unique stuff in it, like that they indicted Trump himself, and there's the whole RICO element to it. The Michigan case seems very narrow. It's kind of fake electors, and that's it. What is there any work that the Arizona case, which I have not yet read, is doing that is not duplicative of some other state? Which, by the way, it's fine if the each state has its own equities in these cases, and so there's nothing really wrong with cases that are largely duplicative of one another, but there's something very interesting about when states bring something really new to the table. Is there anything? I mean, Boris Epstein is new, Kelly Ward is new. Like, what's distinctive
Christina
about the
Bob
Arizona?
Olson. Christina
Yeah,
Bob.
right. What's distinctive about the Arizona case beyond that?
I think that is really what's distinctive. I mean, one of the things looking at this indictment alongside the other indictments that have been released in these other jurisdictions and ongoing criminal investigations. So I believe there is currently an ongoing criminal investigation in Wisconsin, which took a while to get going, but is now moving. There is a duplicative quality, right? Particularly if you read them alongside the Georgia indictment and the federal January 6 indictment. They're all describing the same sort of bucket of conduct, which is this effort to put together fake slates of electors and transport that to the National Archives and to Mike Pence. And you see some distinctions among states as to how that was done in ways that end up being very important. So, in Pennsylvania and I believe in New Mexico, there's qualifying language in the fake certificate that essentially says, we're doing this just because we might later be determined to be the duly qualified electors. And in both Pennsylvania and New Mexico, the respective attorney generals of those states essentially said, look, we don't think we can prosecute this because that kind of negates the potential criminal intent. Interestingly, in New Mexico, the attorney general actually proposed criminal legislation that would allow prosecuting that case anyway. I think that there was legislation introduced that I believe has now stalled out in the New Mexico legislature. Pennsylvania basically said, we're just not going to move forward with this.
I mean, I gotta say, I think if you clearly label what you're doing as fake electors, right? If you have a bunch of fake electoral certificates that say basically on them, "No warning, fake electors here," I think that's First Amendment free speech, and I don't think that should be illegal. And by the way, that gets awfully close to the situation in Hawaii in 1960, where the role of alternative electors was entirely legitimate. I think the problem with what the Trump people did in this campaign was not that they set up alternative slates of electors, but that they misrepresented it and them and sent them to the National Archive. And so I gotta say, I don't really think there's anything wrong with an alternative electors scheme. Am I being too soft?
So I have not looked at the legislation that was proposed by New Mexico Attorney General Torres. That I put this on the table. If it is passed, I am sure someone will challenge it on First Amendment grounds. I mean, I do think that gets to something important though, which is like, as we have all been learning when it comes to the New York criminal case, state law is weird. One of the things that you learn looking at these different indictments is there are like kind of weird state laws. So in the Georgia indictment, of course, we had that strange charge that had to do with violation of the oath, which, Anna, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe Judge McAfee tossed out, correct?
Yes.
So that's only in that is a Georgia statute. I do not know of any comparable statute on any other state, and you don't see that charge. Michigan has this weird charge that's something called uttering and publishing, which
Sounds like bad news for lawfare. We
exactly.
do a lot of honoring and publishing.
But it has to do with forgery. New Mexico, for example, one of the things that Attorney General Torres pointed to in his final report is that New Mexico doesn't have laws that criminalize the submission of election documents and impersonating public officers in the way that Michigan and Georgia do. So just states have different sets of tools in the toolbox. And so I think the interesting thing to me in looking at these different prosecutions is less, you know, what new information we learn, because frankly, the fact pattern is pretty much the same everywhere. There might be some things around the margins, but there's not a huge amount of new information so far that could change. And more kind of seeing how different state law enforcement agencies use the different tools available at the state level to bring these prosecutions, which is, you know, the magic of federalism, I suppose. And also, I think there's something important to it, particularly in light of the fact that, frankly, Trump is running for president again, and the fact that, you know, we have these state governments, some of which are in states that, you know, may well remain blue, that are showing that they are interested in prosecuting this kind of election chicanery. And, you know, even if Trump is in charge of the Justice Department and can shut down, you know, any kind of federal investigation into that kind of activity, you know, he has no power over the Michigan Attorney General or the New Mexico Attorney General. And so I do think there is kind of a powerful, a sort of backstop effect here in having all of these different state investigations. I should also say, because I do think it's important, you know, there's a way you could frame what I just said as a kind of, you know, how dare they get two bites at the apple? This is a double jeopardy problem, right? I don't think it is for a variety of reasons. But one of them is that, you know, it is totally legitimate for a state to be concerned about people trying to, you know, interfere with a transfer of electoral votes from that state. Like it the federal government is concerned about that. But, of course, the state of Michigan should be worried about people falsely representing themselves as electors from that state.
Yeah, so I just want to say, oh, sorry, go ahead, Roger.
Just to Ben's point, I just want to say, Jack Smith in the indictment in D.C. sort of says what Ben says, that, some of these electors were acting legitimately and they were themselves victims. They were tricked. And also that sometimes the theory evolved from a legitimate theory into a criminal theory. So, Jack Smith recognizes what Ben is saying.
So I just want to say on the duplicative point, I think the word duplicative was hasty on my part. A serial killer who goes from state to state, and we would not say the charges are duplicative. That's the nature of serial offense, or in this case, concurrent offense. And there are no double jeopardy problems associated with multiple charges by different sovereigns. And so the issue here is not one of duplication in any legal sense. It's really just more, does it feel like the same stuff that we've already seen indicted? And obviously, every state has the right to enforce that itself. But from an intellectual point of view, if you're saying, okay, what's new in Arizona? The fact that they've indicted a bunch of state electors for a state elector scheme is, not new or surprising. All right. So, anything else on state level fake electors stuff?
That's really the gist of it. I will just say I'm going to be really interested to see how this plays out going forward. In particular, whether Arizona tries to take the next step in actually indicting Trump. In Michigan, we've had this indictment out there for a while at this point. I think someone helpfully pointed out in the chat that it was handed up in July 2023. So, it's impossible that they're still investigating Trump. We haven't seen any indication of it. I would be interested to see if, this Arizona indictment is kind of the opening salvo, and the attorney general decides to actually go forward with indicting Trump, and particularly because I don't know enough about Arizona politics to have a clear sense of how this would go. But you can tell a story where politically, that could be advantageous or disadvantageous in some way. So I think it's worth keeping an eye on. Oh, and I should also say there's an ongoing investigation in Wisconsin. It took a while to get started, but there has been reporting that again, Chesbrough is cooperating, that the Wisconsin Attorney General's office is investigating, and we will see if that does end up moving forward.
All right, from the state of Arizona in all its dry dustiness and beautiful desert vistas to Fort Pierce, Florida, however you want to characterize it, let's talk about the latest in the slowest moving case in the world. There has been a flurry of action on the part of Eileen Cannon. Roger, is it moving forward or is it a flurry of action running in place or even skipping backwards?
Well, it's sort of moving forward. She's unsealing, unredacting lots and lots of stuff. That's obviously in preparation for holding hearings on lots of stuff. But there are some mysteries as well. Formally, this case is supposed to start in less than 3 weeks. We're still set for trial on May 20th.
I think Justice Merchan might have something to say about that.
Yeah. There's some, there's a Section 5 notice that I've mentioned before that's an important turning point. That's supposed to happen in 8 days on May 9th. Trump has said, I can't do that because I'm on trial in New York. And this special counsel has objected because the judge knew about the trial when she set this date. All of that's been fully briefed for 2 weeks. We don't know what's happening there. There has been occasion where she sort of rules by passive aggression. She fails to rule. She sort of plays chicken with the attorneys as they approach the deadline. And she did this once with the special counsel, and they caved because they knew that she would hold them in contempt if she didn't meet the deadline. I don't know if she's doing that to Trump, but I sort of doubt it. I think we'll eventually get a ruling. So anyway, she's in the process of unsealing lots and lots of things, and she's protecting the name, but basically only the name. And this means that a lot of these witnesses are really identifiable at this point. And that puts some of us in a funny position, but I think it's obvious the judge has ruled this is public, and the special counsel has failed to take her up to the 11th Circuit. And I think we, you know, need to report on what's there. But you do have this strange thing where, you know, like what happens with Jenks material, stuff that's usually secret, is, you know, people are frank in their FBI interviews. They don't think these are going to be public. And so you'll have, you know, person 16 will say person 5 is a complete moron. Person 16 says person 24 is unhinged and crazy. And we basically know who person 24 is. And it's not Sidney Powell, by the way. But so there's all of these things. And we are learning more about the case. What we're going to get now is a lot of the motion, Trump's motions that are and Nauta's, based on alleged selective and vindictive prosecution and on prosecutorial misconduct. And of course, these motions really play into Trump's campaign themes that I'm persecuted, you know, you would never be doing this to another president. And they would like to hold hearings on these questions over 3 days between July 1st and July 3rd. Well, that happens to be less than 2 weeks before the Republican convention. So, you know, they want to get out all of these sort of talking points. And it could be that that's where we're going. At the time of Trump's indictment, there was a flurry of stuff about a flap involving Woodward and whether a prosecutor had mentioned that he knew that Woodward had been nominated for a judgeship. And, gee, it would be a shame if something happened to that golden opportunity for you, and things might be better if your client flipped. Obviously, we've gotten now that whole saga, all of that briefing has become unsealed in the last week. And we know at least the government's view. Obviously, the government's view is it didn't happen. They didn't know who Stanley Woodward was. They looked him up online and they saw, if you go to Google and you click on Stanley Woodward, you'll see a thing that says something about nominating committee. They clicked on nominating committee and they thought that he was on the nominating committee. And they told him, as a professional thing, congratulations, we notice you're on the nominating committee. And then Woodward corrected them and said, no, I'm not on the committee. I'm actually a nominee. And obviously, they claimed that they never in a million years. And, you know, it would be odd for a 30-year veteran of the Justice Department in the presence of three other federal prosecutors to try to extort and bribe and intimidate the opposing counsel in this way. And nothing was said about this incident for 9 months, you know, but this happened in August 2022. And nobody said anything until they got their target letters. And then, you know, 3 days before the indictment came down, Trump's lawyers made this accusation. And in the context of trying to stall and, you know, we'd like more material. And then Woodward did confirm in a letter, essentially confirmed that his view that this is what had happened. And he wanted the OPR, Office of Professional Responsibility, to investigate it. And he wanted an indictment to be postponed until OPR had made an assessment. So it was all in the context of delay, which further, you know, draws into question. But in any event, it's not a great thing for this special counsel. And the person who's the fact finder is Eileen Cannon. So, you know, this is not a great thing either. And it is a factual dispute, which seems to justify an evidentiary hearing. And you got to wonder, where are we going? Are we going to have, you know, Jay Bratt on the stand and then the other three prosecutors that were in on the call? I mean, none of these people have yet filed any affidavits, including Woodward. He submitted a letter and the other just signed briefs. So it's not a great thing.
And it has a very Fulton County
it does.
Feel to,
I mean,
it.
It is if very you, if Fulton County. Yeah.
If you exclude the, like, there's no sex involved in it. And but there's a, you know, this idea that you can effectively defend the client by creating or alleging with whatever degree, you can't have no truth to it because then you become sanctionable for a frivolous filing. But you find some read of truth, which in Fulton County turned out to be a bit more than a read. But you find something to create what's essentially a collateral attack on the prosecution in the form of the alleged ethical misconduct of the prosecutors. And it's, you know, it's a very old tactic, but it's interesting that it is now showing up in two of the four major cases here.
Yeah, and there's no sex in it.
Not yet.
In two respects, it's sort of worse for the government in that, one, well, I maybe this isn't worse for the government, but it really fits with all of Trump's campaign points. I'm persecuted. This is selective, vindictive. The other big difference, and it does, this does favor Trump, is the judge, who is really receptive to any hint that the special counsel did anything wrong. She is not only receptive, she has initiated, you know, explorations. You know, she has told them without them, you know, sua sponte, on her own, she says, "What I want you to tell me what's going on. It was the D.C. grand jury abused, you know, are they abusing the D.C. grand jury when I've got the case and what happened there?" And in fact, even the Stanley Woodward stuff, you know, 2 months after this was first reported in The Guardian, I think Hugo Lowell was the first to report this mess. She on her own issues a then sealed order to the parties. "I want to know everything that happened about that, you know, in my role as an independent monitor of, you know, the integrity of these proceedings." So she on her own, you know, really explored. And so these are not great signs for the special counsel.
Well, it's been a while, Roger, since you saw a great sign for the special counsel in the Southern District of Florida.
Yeah, or anywhere else.
Well, I don't know. I mean, okay. as one wag said to me, wandering out of the courthouse the other day in New York, "This looks like it's the only game in town." And the thing that prompted that wag to say that was that we were all sort of watching the proceedings with one eye and watching not our phones, because that brings down the wrath of the New York court police on you, but watching our streams on our computer for information about the Supreme Court oral argument on Thursday in the immunity case. So let's talk about that. I listened to it after I watched everybody panicking about it. And I gotta say, I thought it was a much less bad argument than I would have thought from the panics that I was reading contemporaneously with it being described. And while it was taking place, and I was heartened by the superb discussion that you all had about it the next morning on the Lawfare podcast. But let me start by fleshing out or describing how I read the argument. And then Quinta and Roger, tell me why I am a ray of sunshine in the face of the perfect storm that is going to swamp our little boat. First of all, I was not at all surprised to see that there was a group of justices who are concerned about the clear statement rule issue. I've been saying since Quinta and I wrote a piece about it, actually since before that, Quinta and I wrote a piece about this briefing at the district court level, and I wrote an earlier one with Sarafin Danani before the motion was even filed. Here's what we can expect. Saying that, like, this is actually a serious issue, and that there is no absolute immunity is an easy issue, but how you craft the ways in which the law affects the presidency differently from other institutions and other individuals is actually super tricky. And so I looked and I said, okay, maybe Clarence Thomas is into the absolute immunity thing, but even Justice Alito, confronted with Mr. Sauer, described him as taking an extreme position, didn't seem into the absolute immunity argument. Moreover, I thought Amy Coney Barrett sounded very thoughtful and careful on the subject of how you would read the statutes in question. And the Chief Justice, who clearly has a problem with the D.C. Circuit ruling, did not seem to me to be gunning for the principle that, although Brett Kavanaugh kind of did, but the Chief Justice didn't seem to be gunning for the principle that any statute that doesn't name the president specifically doesn't cover him at all. And then Amy Coney Barrett elicited from Sauer a pretty candid admission that a huge range of the acts described in the indictment aren't official acts anyway. And so I was left with I don't want to say sanguine, because the Supreme Court's capacity to disappoint me is legion, but I would say not panicked, sense that there are almost certainly 5 votes for something reasonable, which is not to say, so, you know, affirmance of the D.C. Circuit in its entirety, but an opinion that will let the body of this case go forward. And the only real question in my mind is timing. And so, Quinta, Roger, how am I wrong?
I don't think I disagree with you on the substance of what you just said. I think my main disagreement is on that last point about timing, because timing is kind of the whole ballgame here. And I was struck throughout oral arguments how the court seemed to drift away from the facts at issue in this specific case, and kind of move toward, you know, hypotheticals, how this might play out down the line, reading big chunks of Scalia's Morrison dissent for some reason, you know, sort of thinking about much bigger issues, which I think connects to Justice Gorsuch's stated desire to settle this issue for the ages, as he said, rather than just confining themselves to the case in front of them, which normally we would call judicial restraint, and conservatives would be a big fan of it. And I found that frustrating because it speaks to an almost perverse unwillingness to imagine what is right in front of everyone's eyes, which is the longer that the court takes to think through these issues, the more likely it is that this case does not go to trial before the election. You can make an argument, and I think Jack Goldsmith has set out this view very capably on Lawfare, that, you know, such considerations are not appropriate for the court to consider. The point where I think I diverge is that, you know, throughout oral argument, the justices were not, you know, this was not a situation where they were saying, you know, fiat justitia erat coelum, right? Let justice be done, though the heavens fall. It's our job to think only about, you know, the high principles and let the chips fall where they may. You guys pick up the pieces afterward. They were very alive to the potential practical consequences of a ruling in one direction or the other, which is how you got these kind of wacky hypotheticals from, you know, Justice Gorsuch saying, like, but what if presidents started always pardoning themselves? Alito having this kind of bizarre suggestion of, you know, but what if the president was incentivized to try to illegally hold on to power? You know, that there really is a thinking, a sort of, they're conscious of how what they do here will create perhaps unintended incentives for presidents going forward. And so it strikes me as willfully averting their eyes, you know, to focus on that, but then ignore, as kind of a matter of, you know, politeness, essentially, the obvious practical consequences from the question of how long it takes them to get a ruling and what the kind of procedural disposition of the ruling is if they kick it back so we end up having a ton more pretrial litigation, or whether they just send it back to Judge Chutkan saying, like, okay, get on it, you know, you can figure out these immunity issues through evidentiary rulings. Now, you could argue that, you know, you could draw a distinction between those different considerations, but the more I think about oral arguments, the more frustrating I found it that the justices were unwilling to confront that head on. And by the way, like, I'm not being partisan here. This is a critique that I would apply equally to the liberal justices. It's a critique that I made about a similar unwillingness to consider consequences in one direction but not the other during the 14th Amendment litigation. I just think that the court, in kind of its desire to seem above the fray and, you know, weigh in on these important questions for the ages, is ignoring what's right in front of it, which is that if you want to have an answer for the ages, that is assuming that, you know, in those ages, in the future, your institution will continue to exist. And the Supreme Court will continue to exist as a body that can provide checks on a president. And the more that they kind of, you know, twiddle their pens thinking through these complex issues that don't need to be resolved, the more and more likely it is that it will not persist, because practically speaking, the more likely it is that Donald Trump will be elected as the next president of the United States. And I think it feels to me, I'm sorry, I'm just ranting at this point, but it feels to me that there's a sense among the commentariat and among the sort of, you know, rarefied world of the justices that making such a point is kind of uncouth. And maybe it is, but I do feel like there is a certain unwillingness to raise your head to look at the, you know, the headlights of the oncoming train barreling toward you.
Roger, what are your thoughts about the oncoming train barreling toward you?
Well, a couple of things. When we had this podcast right after the argument, about 45 minutes after the argument, I would say. So I was bleaker than I've had a chance to read the transcript. There is, as election analysts say, a pathway to some sort of acceptable outcome. I do think it is possible you could count to five here. Justice Barrett was very good, and you have, if Chief Justice is sort of the swing vote. So with him, you have five. As Ben says, he's not going to say, yep, affirm. He wanted the D.C. Circuit to engage more than it did. I think everyone is doing a disservice to what the D.C. Circuit really did do, which is, you know, they didn't say there is no immunity. They say this case is easy because of these facts. And so we decide this one, but it's going to have to be case by case. And that's the way constitutional adjudication used to work. It isn't like Justice Gorsuch says, we're writing a ruling for the ages. So we're going to tell everybody, you know, what's legal and what isn't legal in the future. That's not how the common law has ever worked. So I agree with Ben. You can get to five. I agree with Quinta. You probably can't get a ruling in time to do anything with it. And I disagree with Jack Goldsmith that, you know, this notion that it's political to take into account something that everyone can see in front of their faces. It's political either way. You know, it's just like with the gerrymandering, the political gerrymandering case where, you know, five Republican appointees say, you know, we might appear political if we were to intervene with gerrymandering that generally favors Republican candidates. You're not preserving any credibility. You're not staying out of politics. You are, in this case, you know, you are saving this guy from a criminal indictment. And why are you doing that? It's in a federal court in, you know, down the street from you, you know, three blocks. It's not, you know, well, I don't want to name a country where we might not trust the judicial system. So I'm disappointed in that respect, as Quinta is. And I don't think you have to even go to, well, democracy won't exist anymore if he's elected. I think you do have to say, if he's elected, we know enough about him to say he will fire the special prosecutor and he will direct his attorney general to dismiss this. And that, you know, not too long ago, that would have been, you know, 100 times worse than the Saturday night massacre. You know, that would have been an impeachable offense back when there were impeachable offenses. And so, you know, to ignore that, in fact, they've already intervened. They've prevented any possibility of getting a judgment before the inauguration. So they've already intervened. That was their decision to accept cert the second time it was offered to them. So I don't buy any notion that these people are not acting politically by preventing this thing from being tried.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, Lawfare listeners. Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay.
And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20.
All right. So, from the highest minded writing of rules for the ages to the lowest down and dirty, sleazy tabloid publishers and the lawyers who interface with them, let's go to the only game in town, New York County Supreme Court, where Anna and I have been hanging out with the dust and the dirt balls, some of them human. So we've been doing the details of the case on the daily live streams. I don't want to be repetitive of that. But Anna, we've now had a week and a half of this nuttiness. What are your impressions of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm someone who came into this case. It's one of those cases that, you know, we've covered Fulton County and Mar-a-Lago and the DC case in such great detail that for a long time, this case was a little bit of one that we just didn't pay as much attention to. You know, we certainly were following it, but our coverage was just not as detailed as in the other cases. And so I came to this case very interested to see, you know, what I would think when the evidence started being presented. I had heard criticism of the case. I also had reason to think that it was a case that seemed somewhat promising for the prosecution in other respects. So I kind of came into it with an open mind. I have been very impressed so far by what the prosecution has managed to do and the case that they are building. I want to speak about it at a pretty high level instead of getting into what we heard this week, because we do have those daily dispatches. But I think that it was a very smart move for them to put David Pecker as the first witness. He is one of the so-called dirtbags that you've described. He's the former publisher of the National Enquirer. And despite the fact that he looks like he's straight from Central Casting as this, you know, kind of sleazy, newspaper public tabloid publisher, he, in fact, came across as very credible, was able to really set out this whole scene and narrative that really set the scene for this prosecution and for this hush money scheme for the falsification of the records. And then this week, some of the things that we got as well were more, kind of moves on the chessboard to go ahead and set up some of the more documents that the jury will need to make their decision. So we heard a lot of documents, witnesses yesterday in court, a guy from C-SPAN, a guy from a court reporting company, because there's some things from E. Jean Carroll's deposition that Trump sat for in October that are coming into evidence. So we got that. But then we also got this guy, Gary Farrow, who looks like a bouncer, or Ben thinks he looks like a bouncer, but he's in fact a former banker, or he's still a banker. But
no, he objectively looks like a bouncer.
Well, you saw him in court, so I will give you that. He is a banker who worked at First Republic Bank, which is the bank that Michael Cohen used to send funds to Stormy Daniels' attorney when the hush money scheme was agreed to in terms of the Stormy Daniels matter. And, you know, I think that with Gary Farrow's testimony, it was getting a lot of documents in. He was also a fact witness as well that could testify to, for example, when Cohen was filling out these bank forms to create an account so that he could then send the funds over to Stormy Daniels. He was saying, for example, that it's not affiliated with a political candidate. He basically made misrepresentations on these banking forms. And so that was, I think, an important part to get through, is get in these documents, get in a lot of the story of Stormy Daniels, which we didn't get with Pecker last week. The reason being that Pecker is someone who was involved in the Karen McDougal payment and the Dino Sajudin payment, but kind of, you know, put his foot down when it came to paying Stormy Daniels. So we got in a lot of this evidence that we're going to hear from Michael Cohen about. But because of Cohen's credibility problems and the issues that have been raised in terms of the defense attacking his credibility, I think that it's very good that a lot of this corroborating evidence is coming in now, as opposed to going ahead and putting Cohen on the stand. The jury's going to kind of be already have a lot of this corroborated in their mind before they hear directly from Michael Cohen, because every single witness that gets on the stand so far has indeed said things like, Michael Cohen exaggerates, Michael Cohen is always screaming, Michael Cohen is an asshole, Michael Cohen's a jerk. I mean, truly, it is.
One of them in a meta commentary even said, the moral of the story is nobody wants to deal with Michael Cohen.
Right, exactly. And then finally, the person who we left off with yesterday on direct examination was Keith Davidson. Again, someone who I expected actually to be a bit of a sleazy guy. He's this, you know, in your mind. We heard some about him. He's an attorney in California who works with people in the entertainment business. He represented Karen McDougal and her hush money deal with AMI. He also represented Stormy Daniels when she was negotiating a deal first with AMI and then with Cohen. And, you kind of imagine in your mind that he's going to be this, you know, kind of David Pecker type guy and just be quite the character. But in fact, he was incredibly dry, very straightforward, very kind of soft spoken, and seemed quite credible. But I think, you know, again, with his testimony, we got more text messages. We got more of the Stormy Daniels story. Again,
we got a great band name.
We got a great band name, the Estrogen Mafia.
That's me and Anna. Correct.
Yeah, that's me, Quinta, Natalie. Maybe we can get Catherine, all the Lawfare ladies to start the Estrogen Mafia band. So I think that was important. And then we also got as well from Davidson the fact that he testified to this idea that as he was negotiating this deal with Cohen, he talked about his understanding of the deal and why, you know, who the clients were. That was Cohen and Daniels and Trump, and who, you know, would have been hurt by the story that, that Daniels had coming out. And at one point, you know, he said, I understood it to be the case that Donald Trump would be hurt by this story. And so that was one of the motivations for Cohen, you know, undertaking this deal on behalf of his client. And then also when he said that Trump would be hurt, it would be the case that the, you know, the campaign would be hurt. And so I think that it's important that they can, the prosecution is continuing to get that type of testimony into the record, in which, you know, you have multiple people, Pecker, and then now Davidson, saying that, you know, that these deals were being done because they believe that it related to Trump's, you know, campaign as opposed to his family or other reasons or reputation, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think that's my main points. Todd Blanche did struggle some on cross-examination of, for example, Gary Farrow yesterday. It didn't seem like there was a clear line of cross-examination inquiry. But at the same time, there were some weak spots with the prosecution as well yesterday, specifically at one point on direct examination. They were trying to elicit some information from Keith Davidson. We do not know what that information is because they never got to ask the question, but they just kept trying over and over and over again to get Keith Davidson to, you know, testify to something that it sounds like he testified to in grand jury testimony, but they never got to it because of the objections were sustained. Ben, what are your thoughts? I'm curious to hear your overarching thoughts as well.
Well, I'm going to give my overarching thoughts, but I'm going to do something a little bit out of order because Quinta has to drop off in a few minutes, and there are some questions in the queue. By the way, if you have questions in, that are not in the queue, get them in the queue in the next 6 minutes before the estimable Anna Hickey turns off the queue. But there are a few questions in the queue that I want to direct to Quinta. So the first is from Linda. How might these other states' actions, Arizona, New Mexico, Michigan, et al., prompt Fani Willis to act to expedite the case in Fulton County? That's partly an Anna question, partly a Quinta question. So I throw it out. Let's do the Quinta half of it before we can return to the Anna half of it after Quinta's gone.
So I don't know if there's a huge amount of overlap. I think you have Meadows, Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, and Mike Roman, which I will just say, I'm very proud of myself for listing that off the top of my head. I think are at the center of the Venn diagram in terms of people who are indicted both in Arizona and in Georgia. I don't believe there is any overlap between the Georgia and the Nevada indictment or the Michigan indictment, because those are more confined to the electors within those states. And I would need to double check this to be 100% sure, but the theories on which prosecutors are bringing those cases are a lot less involved, let's say, than the RICO case. It's more sort of, you know, falsification of documents, conspiracy to falsify documents, like impersonating a public, official, that kind of thing. So there are conspiracy elements, as you would kind of expect under the circumstances, but there's nothing quite so sprawling as the Georgia RICO charge. So I'm actually just not sure. I mean, I can imagine that Willis might, you know, want to get things moving, but she's already well ahead of the game in terms of bringing her case to trial. The others are still moving through the process, and there are all these back and forth with defendants, you know, trying to challenge indictments and remove cases to federal court and so on and so forth. So I would not be surprised if it was quite a while before those cases go to trial, and Willis is kind of already ahead of the game.
Although I will say that because none of those cases are as sprawling as hers, they're much less likely to get derailed by complexity, which is not to say they have no prospect of being derailed by complexity. But, you know, when Fani Willis brought that case, it was kind of unclear And we said so in, I think, the first paragraph of our first piece about this, that whether this is, you know, touched by genius or grossly so overly complicated that she's going to trip herself badly and really have overcharged it is kind of an open question. And by the way, almost a year later, it's still an open question. And I don't think that's true of some of these other state cases. They're the sort of other model of how to do these things, which is much more economical, much more targeted. And there are some defense lawyers in Georgia, particularly our sometime Lawfare joiner of the show, Andrew Fleischman, who really criticized her for that and said, look, there was a simple case to bring here and she brought a complicated case. And so I wouldn't be entirely surprised if some of those cases actually move faster than the Fulton County case for that reason. But yes, she certainly has a head start.
That's definitely true. Just one quick thing. It is also true that at least in the Michigan case, I think the judge has really been struggling just under the weight of how much evidence and how many defendants there are, because there are a bunch. So I think her name is Judge Simmons. Has had to delay a bunch of the preliminary hearings, push them back by a couple of months just because there's so much information. So, you know, that's may well be the case in Georgia as well. But just I think these state courts may not be prepared for sort of just the sheer volume of evidence that is going to be thrown at them in these instances.
All right. One more question for Quinta before you jump off. Anonymous attendee asks each of us, and the only one who's going to get the question now is you. Do you think it's inevitable the special counsel will seek a writ of mandamus from the 11th Circuit, reigning in Judge Cannon? And at this point, what action has she yet to take that might trigger this?
I'm going to defer to you all on this one. I will just say that I think something as dramatic as seeking a writ of mandamus is never inevitable. But I will be interested to go back and listen to this and hear what you all have to say.
All right.
I will hop off. Thank you all.
Right. We say goodbye to Quinta, and I will give you, before we actually do the questions properly, I will give you my overarching thoughts about the New York case. The first of which is that I very much agree with Anna. People have been mistakenly saying that this is a weak case. Weakness is a comment on the quality of the evidence. The quality of the evidence in this case is not weak. Like, this is a very strong case. And as the volume of material that the prosecution is putting forward mounts and mounts and mounts, the strength of the case is—it's becoming very clear to me, at least, that criticism is wrong. What people mean when they say it's a weak case is that they think it's a trivial case, or that the case does not warrant the having been brought. Or having been brought in this way because the actions in question are sort of too trivial, or it took too long to bring, or Alvin Bragg's predecessor contemplated a more substantial case. The case is not weak. So that's the first thing. The second thing is I have gone back and forth over whether and to what extent it is a good thing or a bad thing for the weight of democracy to rest on the case that has the least anti-democratic overtones of the four. So this is not a purloining of classified information. This is not an attempt to overthrow the electoral system, either as seen through the Georgia RICO statute or as seen through, you know, 371 and 1512C2. But it is at the end of the day, a case about falsifying business records to cover up payments to people you had affairs with or who you may have had affairs with or whatever, to keep them quiet in the run up to an election. And it's an interesting sort of question whether that is in the world for which we would pray, the question for which you would hold Donald Trump accountable. And I have always been a skeptic of that point and said things like, this is the least important of the four. Notice that the least important of the four is not the same as saying that the evidence is weak. I'm beginning to think that that may have been wrong, and that this is exactly the case that he should be like it, that I'm fine with this being the one that goes to trial before November. And the reason is because it is tawdry, you know, because it is exactly as gross as Donald Trump, because the lead witness is somebody as disgusting as David Pecker, because, you know, you come around to a guy like Keith Davidson, who had not one but two clients in 2016 who wanted to gouge money from Donald Trump by way of keeping their stories quiet about affairs with them. And the more wholesome of them was a Playboy model. And that, by the way, Keith Davidson is way less scummy than a lot of the other people who've testified and will testify in this case. You know, and because of all that, there is something weirdly fitting about the fact that this is the case that should rear up and bite him in the ass in the year, by the way, that he's trying to do exactly the same thing again, which is cover up a whole lot of nasty stuff, lie about a whole lot of stuff that he's done, and get elected by controlling the information stream. And that is exactly what this case is about. And I don't, having sat through it, I don't honestly look forward to hearing from Stormy Daniels or Michael Cohen, but I don't feel like this case is a irrelevancy to our current situation right now. And I think it is, there is something very appropriate about this case. I'm reminded of the opening monologue of The Big Lebowski. You know, sometimes there is a man, and I'm not saying he's a brave man, or like he's a lazy man. He's certainly a lazy man. Like sometimes there's a case, and I'm not saying that it's the most important case in the world, but boy, is it a fitting case for this here moment in time. And so I will just say that's my impression as I sit through hours and hours and hours of it, that it's kind of the case he deserves. All right, let's go to audience questions. So somebody asked, by the way, am I going to be doing the Google Sheets questions? And the answer is, if people have left comments in questions in there, I will go to them, but I'm going to deal with these ones first, just because I have them here. So Matt asks, at oral argument in the immunity case, Trump's counsel relied heavily on the argument that in drawing the line between official and non-official acts, the court should not focus on the alleged motive behind the charged conduct, because the indictment will allege in every case that the defendant had acted with corrupt intent, and that threatens to undermine the concept of immunity by requiring virtually every case to be resolved at trial. This argument has a lot of practical appeal, and the justices seemed swayed by it, but doesn't it run into a textual problem, given that the immunity is supposedly based on the Take Care Clause, and the plain text of the clause directs the president to faithfully execute the laws? Doesn't that language place the good faith of the president squarely at issue in every case where he claims to be fulfilling his duty under the Take Care Clause? So I'm going to take a quick crack at this and then turn it over to Roger and Anna for any thoughts they have on the subject. The first thing to say about this is immunity as a general matter, at least if it's absolute immunity, always ignores intent. In the sense that, you know, if you're talking about speech and debate clause immunity, It doesn't matter if the intent is willful. That's what distinguishes between immunity and lacking, say, the criminal intent, which is often an element of the offense. Immunity says, you know, I was with the ambassador of Ukraine. This is literally a true story. On Saturday, I was with Ambassador Makarova, and we were going to plant sunflowers outside the Russian embassy. And a policeman said, no, you can't do that. It's illegal, which was false, by the way. And so for Ambassador Makarova to invoke her diplomatic immunity and do it anyway, she would have to willfully and intentionally defy this cop, which, of course, she did not do. That's immunity, right? You don't ask when you then assess, can she be prosecuted for that, whether she did it intentionally, whether what her motives were. You say the nature of her position is such that U.S. criminal law cannot be enforced against her, even if she did it maliciously, defiantly, whatever motivation you say. I think that's one of the reasons why it is wrong to think about this question in the language of immunity. And by the way, the Take Care Clause is one example of why I think that's right. I think if you're talking about immunity in the absolute sense in which we dispense it in other contexts, it's very hard to understand why somebody who takes an oath to take care that the laws be faithfully executed and that the Constitution explicitly contemplates prosecution under certain circumstances can be considered immune. So I don't actually believe that that is the basis on which the court will resolve this case. And for many reasons, one of which is the text of the Take Care Clause. Roger, Anna, do you have thoughts on this?
A small point. I don't think they were locating the immunity, source of the immunity in the Take Care Clause. They were locating it in the Vesting Clause, the Executive Vesting Clause, and then plus some language in Marbury. But certainly you're right. I mean, a crucial thing in their case is that it has to be an objective standard. You can't get into motive. You know, in the civil case, Blasingame, the D.C. Circuit sort of said, they developed a workaround and they said, look, you know, we'll use this distinction between office holder and office seeker. And that's a relatively objective thing. And we don't have to look into motive. And that's something that could, if need be applied here, possibly without disastrous results. It sounded like Alito was toying with the idea of using a totally implausible standard, where if something, the notion that this was an official act was totally implausible under the circumstances, he would allow a prosecution to go forward. I doubt that that sounded broad enough that it might help Trump. But other judges, like I think the Chief Justice, there was a lot of emphasis on that what you have here is the trappings of official acts, but they're being used for a personal purpose. So it seemed to me that they were willing to go to motive, that there was no getting around it. And that's what I took from the Chief Justice's discussion of bribery, that, you know, bribery doesn't, you know, appointing an ambassador is an official act. It might be a core, executive function, but taking money to appoint a particular person is bribery, and it's clearly punishable. And you can't cut it in two and say, okay, we'll prosecute the taking of the money, but you can't mention to the jury that it's in exchange for an ambassadorship. So I think they're going to have to allow, I think they're going to break through that motive issue in some form. I hope I haven't been completely inarticulate.
Oh, we're all inarticulate most of the time when we do things live. That's part of the fun of it. All right, we're going to do some rapid fire questions. Jeff writes, What are the lunch options when covering the New York Trump trial? Are they as good as the fried grouper sandwiches down in South Florida in Fort Pierce? I will just say, I'm going to let Anna answer the grouper question. I will just say on the lunch options, they are diverse and range in quality. I was surprised at the quality of the vegan pho that I had the other day. I was less thrilled with some of the pickup sushi. But the tacos that Anna and I had yesterday were Lower Manhattan is, you know, I can't compare it to the Fort Pierce grouper, but Lower Manhattan food choices are pretty hard to beat on a fast casual basis. Anna, what are your thoughts on fried grouper?
Well, I will say for lunch options in Fort Pierce during court, I think that I only ate like a bag of Cheez-Its because that's all they had in the vending machine. There's really not much around that courthouse. But there are very few foods that can beat a cold beer and the fried grouper at the Tiki Bar next to the motel in Fort Pierce, where I have stayed and Roger has had the pleasure of staying several times. But with that said, the tacos that we got in New York yesterday during lunch, Ben is right, can't really be beat. So everyone go to Los Tacos number one. I think am I right about the name, Ben?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's it. And we've also had some soup too. We had some very sad soup one day, but the other than that, the lunch options have been pretty good.
Just if I can add that the Cuban coffee in Southern Florida in the Mervis in near the courthouse is to die for.
All right. Anonymous attendee, returning to your question for each of us. Do you think it is inevitable that Jack Smith will seek a writ of mandamus from the 11th Circuit, reining in Judge Cannon? And at this point, what action has she yet to take that might trigger that? Roger, you go first, since this is your bailiwick.
I think they sort of have to. I don't think you want to go to trial with this judge without trying first some other option. You know, there's just too much, you know, with her choosing the jury, with her writing the instructions. And I think where it could happen is they're asking for a lot of, well, I think it would be the selective and vindictive prosecution. Trump wants a lot of extra discovery, and a lot of it has to do with trying to explore selective and vindictive prosecution. And the standards against that are very, very high. I don't think they've ever been met before. And I think it will be very hard for her not to grant that. I think in her bones, she feels that this was unfair. That's why what she did the last time before the case started, when she appointed the special master, you know, this unprecedented civil remedy to slow down and the prosecutors and keep them from seeing the products of a search obtained from a magistrate, approved by a magistrate. So I think that she can't resist granting some sort of discovery to pursue this selective and vindictive prosecution claim, and that might be the place to appeal.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. She just hasn't done anything yet. I just don't know what it is she's going to do, but I do think I'm with Roger. I think she's going to do something that will trigger Jack Smith seeking an appeal or some type of writ of mandamus at some point. I have the same suspicion that Roger does, that I think Judge Cannon, everything that I've seen, she believes that this is an unfair prosecution and that, you know, I think eventually we're going to reach a point in which there is something that is appealable or mandamusable, if that is a word. But I just don't know yet what that will be.
The other place it could occur would be the motion in limine right before trial, where they bring up the, you know, how are you going to treat the Presidential Records Act? Are you going to let them say that's some sort of a defense to possessing, you know, to willfully retaining national defense information, that can be, a personal record? It might come down to that.
That is what I was about to say. I think they're going to have a lot of motions in limine as this thing gets closer, and they're going to wait for her to do something outrageous on the question of the actual presentation. What arguments are you not allowed to make to the jury? And that they will want a record that very clearly has her doing something lawless on those questions. And that's, I think, what they will take up. All right. Anonymous attendee asks, isn't Justice Gorsuch's desire to make a ruling for the ages legislating from the bench, or tantamount to doing it? I would say something a little bit different, but I'm not going to resist that characterization. It, of course, depends on the nature of the rule. But I would say that it reflects an extremely grandiose conception of the judicial function. And by contrast, I think I've quoted this before, when Byron White was confirmed to the court, back when you could just walk up to justices on the steps of the Supreme Court, which now you would not be able to do. A journalist walked up to him, and it just shows up in his New York Times obituary, by the way, and asks him, what do you think the great constitutional role of the Supreme Court is? And Byron White barked the response, to decide cases. And that reflects my much more modest understanding of the role of the Supreme Court. I've always thought it was the grouchiest and most correct thing ever said about the role of the Supreme Court. And I do think when justices start thinking that they're making rules for the ages, nothing good ever comes of that. And I'd rather that they think, got to decide a case and think about it that way. Anonymous attendee also asks, in the event the jury convicts Trump of a felony in the New York City case, what have you seen so far that might provide the grounds for a successful appeal? Great question. Anna, I have a couple thoughts on this, but let's do yours first.
So I would need to think about what we've seen so far, but I will say that I think one thing I'm looking for as we go forward will be the charging conference and some of the rulings that come out in terms of jury instructions, just because this is, although has been articulated, the evidence is strong. There are some, unprecedented parts of this prosecution that have to do with the legal theory. And so I am very curious to see how some of the jury instructions come out, some of what his various rulings will be in that respect. So that's what I'm looking for. But Ben, I'm interested to hear what your thoughts are on what we've seen so far.
Yes. So I also think that the legal theory will be the source of the appeal, or the principal source of the appeal. And I think a lot will turn on what Justice Merchan instructs the jury as to what they have to find regarding the so-called object offenses. Do they have to all agree about which object offense they find that is satisfied here? At what level does it or the intent to commit it have to be proven? And I think he will likely be pretty conservative on that, at least if he's smart, because honestly, the last thing you want is to get a conviction reversed on that ground. But I do think that's where the complexity / vulnerability of the case probably lies. Okay, we have 5 more minutes and 5 more questions. So I'm going to race through them, try to do a minute a question. Sebastian asks, if Trump had recorded the checks accurately, either as Ms. Daniels biography or National Enquirer advertisement, would there still be a case in New York? And the answer to that is no. If he had recorded it accurately, or if the Trump Organization had, there would not have been falsification of business records with intent to do anything. And therefore, there would not be a crime. Keith asks, I have not seen any coverage on any repercussions to the National Enquirer following David Pecker's admissions on the stand. Maybe the Tiger Woods, et cetera, stuff does not technically constitute extortion, but it sure seems like the Ted Cruz stories would definitely be libel. Is it just statutes of limitations issues or a lack of political incentive for Ted Cruz? I think the answer to that question is yes. Anna, what do you think?
On the latter part of the Ted Cruz?
As in, why are there no political, there are no legal ramifications for, you know, basically making up that Ted Cruz's dad. So with that, by the way, you can't libel the dead. Ted, I'm not sure if Ted Cruz's father is alive or not, but you would have to imagine that he wanted to bring a case. You would also have to imagine in the case of Tiger Woods that Tiger Woods would want to pursue something in which the result of which would be that all these negative stories about him would come out.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But it is also, there are going to be statute of limitations issues there as well. Okay, next question from Suzanne. How can it still be an unsolved mystery whether Trump actually had affairs with Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal? Over the years, what evidence has come to light to suggest they either did or did not have affairs with Trump? And did Pecker, Davidson, and Cohen appear to believe the women or Trump? So a quick answer to this. First of all, I don't think it is much of a mystery. I don't think everybody in the case of McDougal and Stormy Daniels, and particularly McDougal, believed her. There was internal correspondence within AMI that the story was very likely true, but she didn't have any evidence of it. There is some evidence emerging at trial that it was true, which is when Trump was first presented with the Karen McDougal story. He didn't say, "Who the fuck is Karen McDougal? I've never heard of her." He said, "Karen is a nice girl." And he inquires after her a few times how she's doing under the deal. So he's clearly aware of her.
Well, and he also, there also was testimony from Rona Graff in which, who was Trump's executive assistant, and they elicited testimony from her that said that she, you know, had put these contacts into the Trump Organization contacts. And then they showed documents that showed Stormy and then Stormy Daniels' phone number and then, you know, Karen McDougal and Karen McDougal's contact information. So Trump certainly had their contact information. There's also this sighting of Stormy Daniels at Trump Tower that came out through testimony this week as well. So there's, in addition to what Ben said, a number of things that suggest that Trump was, you know, at least knew these women, and it doesn't seem like there's much dispute about, other than, you know, what he has said publicly previously. But amongst other witnesses, there doesn't seem to be much dispute that what they alleged in terms of a romantic or sexual relationship was true.
But it doesn't make any difference legally, does it?
No, not at all. Except in the extremely limited sense that a jury who thought Trump was subject to extortion based on false information might be a hell of a lot more sympathetic to a panicked response than a jury that thought that he was trying to pay off people he'd had affairs with in order to juice an election. All right, we got two more questions. One of them substantive and one of them procedural. Tony asks, in the minutia of federalism, under what legal authorities does the U.S. Secret Service have to direct things in a state courthouse? For example, jurors going through U.S. Secret Service security just seems intimidating. Holding press and public in courtroom to wait for Trump to exit, etc. So the answer is, the authority is very simple. They are charged with the protection of former office holders at that level. And to the extent that they have that authority, that is under the Supremacy Clause, the law of the land, the supreme law of the land, and the state courts have to accommodate them. I will say that the Secret Service behavior in this case, as a lot of you know from my projection work at the Russian embassy, I am a big fan of the Secret Service. I think their behavior in this case has been exemplary. A couple of weeks ago, Ben said to send feedback about coverage to his email address, and then he'd read it on air. And he read the email on air, but when I tried to send something to that account, it bounced. The contact information here seems to be quite out of date, and he gives a very out-of-date website that I should probably take down. Let me give you my email again, benjamin.wittes@lawfaremedia.org. And that's benjamin.wittes@lawfaremedia.org. And people should feel free to email me. If there's a very large volume of emails, I might not respond to every single one of them, but I do try. And by the way, if you're, I just warn people when I give out private information, you have no reasonable expectation of privacy in abusing strangers. And if you send me abusive emails, I do screenshot them and post them to social media with your email address visible. That's just a warning to everybody in general. You're free to email me, but I have the unreviewable discretion to decide whether to make your emails public. So be careful. And by the way, you should be careful. That's true of your interactions with other people too, that some of them just don't say it. We are going to leave it there because Lawfare Live Trump Trials and Tribulations begins and ends on time within a regional margin of error. Thank you to Quinta Jurassic, who's not here anymore. Thank you to Roger Parloff in the Scott studio. Thank you to Anna Bauer in the room about 20 feet away from me. Thank you to Anna Hickey, who is running all of this and making it possible. And thank you to everybody who has joined us and been patient with us as we resolve and continue to work through certain tech glitches that arise when we try to do these things not from home. You're all great Americans, and we will see you next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.